Howdy, folks. It's been a while. It's been a while. Look who decided to show his face again in the podcasting. Well, I've done podcasts. It's not like I've been. This is a great start. The Russia guy's been away for a while. I haven't really had the time or the energy to continue the interview format. And if you listen to the Naked Pravda at Medusa, you know that I already do that. And at one point late last year, it just seemed like I'm doing the same thing twice, and I should not be doing that because it was tiring and boring. So anyway, here we are several months later. And it dawned on me that, the interview format that I have at the Naked Pravda and what the Russia guy had become for the last couple of years it was running, it's one thing. That's one thing. But I don't really get to just sort of, blather on. And that doesn't make it sound very good, does it? But I enjoy doing it. And even if nobody listens to it, it's just kind of fun to review some of the things I've been thinking about, some of the stuff I've been reading. And I listen to a few podcasts where people really do just, the hosts just do that. And it's so self-indulgent, obviously, that I resisted the temptation to join in because, even having a podcast, even if it's like the greatest podcast ever, the idea of I'm a white guy, if I have a podcast, that's like a bad stereotype. And, there's already jokes made to mock me and remind me that's problematic or whatever, but I'm doing it anyway because I enjoy it, I think. Question mark. Anyway, I have a list here. So I have a list here of ideas I think I decided I'd like to talk about. But anyway, so yes, the Russia guy is back for now. Maybe this is a one-off return. I don't know. But I've been thinking about it for the last week, like, hey, I sit down, I do this. So here I am, I'm doing it. Okay. Like I said, I've got a list here of show notes, things I wanted to talk about. It's 11 p.m. on a Saturday night here. My kids are in bed. My wife went to sleep. And I had a Red Bull too late in the day. And I thought, you know what? I got energy. Let's do something. And so the first thing I wanted to mention or talk about, I guess, is Twitter ad revenue sharing. Now, I don't know how many of you out there are on Twitter. Odds are, if you're listening to this podcast, maybe that's how you even knew the episode came out. But anyway, I've tried to establish a presence on Mastodon and Threads and Blue Sky, although whenever I see that name, I want to call it Blueski. It just looks like Blueski to me, because they don't capitalize the S. So it looks like Blueski. But anyway, I have accounts there. I try to cross-post as much as I can, especially with Mastodon. For a while there, I was actually, running Mastodon as the main one. Now I've gone back to just sort of manually cross-posting and not relying on, I was using IFTT, if this, then that, it's like a program or a service where you can have it, it's like automated stuff and they have a thing where you can cross-post. Anyway, so yes, Twitter ad revenue. I got paid $130.86. for ad revenue sharing. Now, there's like, maybe I haven't dug into the account information enough, but from what I could tell, they don't really say why you get this money, exactly what period of activity this money is for. But I will say, it's nice to get it, just a bank transfer for $130 for nothing, for stuff I was already doing. And I don't know if this is something that's sustainable for Twitter, or excuse me, X or Elon Musk. I mean, obviously, Elon Musk could probably manage it for a while. But I don't know if this is something they intend to keep doing, or if it's like a temporary measure to either keep people with X instead of having them flee to other programs or platforms. Honestly, it doesn't seem necessary to me, because I've tried desperately to you know, be active on other platforms, mainly, especially Mastodon, because it has just a lot of, you know, freedom. You know, you can, there's like instances, different sort of subdivisions where the posting rules are different. And I found one, InfoSec, I think it's called InfoSecurity, where, you know, you can like write long posts and you don't have to pay a membership fee or a special fee to get that, that ability. Anyway, I know it's a bit controversial to take money from X right now or Twitter because people don't like Elon Musk because he's let, you know, hate speech back onto the platform. Although I have to say that I personally haven't noticed any change in that. Not that, just all I mean is that it was there before and it's there now. It's just, honestly, the way I look at it is it's the internet and, you know, people are full of hate and other things as well. But if you have people on the, online speaking, then you're going to see that. Now, that's not a very sophisticated or advanced, you know, position on online regulation or what's the word? Curation? No, that's not it. Anyway, censorship would be the nasty word. But, none of that honestly bothers me very much. But I know that people that manage this sort of stuff for a living would think that was a very, you know, dumb position to take. But I am on social media a lot, and that's kind of my perspective, at least. All right, so I am going to take that money, and I don't know what I'm going to spend it on. Honestly, I've probably already spent it. like before I even got the money, I'm sure I'd already spent it. It is interesting. I like the idea of being paid for microblogging, something that I spend a lot of time doing for various reasons, you know. I mean, and honestly, like keeping the public informed is not at the top of that list. It has more to do with just sort of annotating what I'm reading so I can go back and see, oh yeah, that story, I forgot. Because otherwise, yeah, I mean, I could make the notes privately, but then I wouldn't get the endorphins of people telling me what a great public service I am providing. Anyway, all right, so that's Twitter. All right, one of the other interesting news bits of the last week, and now I'm going to switch to some news stuff, I think, was this Luna 25, the new lunar exploration mission from Russia that launched earlier this week. And I think even the headline that I used for the Medusa translation, I think it may have been in the Russian original, was something like, you know, believe it or not, or oh my golly, you know, how unexpected, Russia is returning to the moon. And part of that surprise is that this mission was based on parameters that were kind of in place for almost 50 years now. So it's kind of like, you know, in that sense, it's overdue, I guess is how you might describe it. I think the other surprise is that the space race is, as we knew it, is over, I guess. And also Russia is widely viewed as poor and they're busy with a war in Ukraine and, you know, their invasion there. And how silly, how bizarre that they're going to the moon. I've seen some people respond that, you know, it's indicative of Putin's kind of like outdated thinking, that he still cares about the moon, that it's, you know, a status thing for him, that his mindset is stuck in the past. I mean, on one hand, I understand that. There's certainly some truth to it, I'm sure. The idea that this probably appeals to Russian decision makers because it does have a lot to do with the, you know, the things that made superpowers superpowers. But at the same time, it's not like this is a new space race. And in fact, Russia's literally racing like by the day to this southern lunar pole, to the south pole of the moon. It's racing against India. And India and Russia had been working together on some of the technology for these missions together up until a few years ago. And Japan is going to launch a lunar mission in relatively soon. China and the United States have plans to, you know, return people to the moon. And so in that regard, I don't think that it's fair to say that Russia's lunar mission is like something from a bygone era. I mean, it seems like people are interested in the moon again. And I'm not sure if that's because there's like a new Cold War struggle or if there are legitimate scientific reasons to do that. I know that even, you know, when we went to the moon in the 60s, it was in the 70s, it was, you know, it wasn't exactly a unanimous decision. I know that people are poor then and they're poor now. And so the idea of spending money on what is essentially a scientifically unnecessary thing to get people there, especially. Anyway, I don't really have expertise in this subject, but I will say reading about how Russia is going to get a rocket and then a lander on the lunar surface. Pretty cool stuff. I'm sure I would experience the same thing if I were reading about the Indian mission or the Japanese mission or the Chinese mission or the American mission. And I think that's just maybe the little kid in me, or I don't know, the adult man. Either way, rockets flying to the moon. Fun. One thing I've noticed while just being on social media and getting responses from people, especially when I actually, when I talk, this is something I've noticed, when I talk on, say, Threads about like the lack of people from my Russia watching community having migrated to Threads, or the same thing with Mastodon, or even, I mean, Blue Sky, some of them seem to be there because it seems to be more professionally focused, at least in my field, at least. But when I talk about the Russia watchers, people respond and they say, oh yeah, it's such a bummer. Everybody I follow for Ukraine isn't here yet. And I realize, oh, a lot of the people that follow me, and I, for what I perceive to be Russia analysis, they're looking for things that matter to them because of the Ukraine war. Makes perfect sense. But I will say that I don't fancy myself even remotely a Ukraine expert. I'm very strictly a Russia expert. I don't speak Ukrainian. I don't have anything I know about Ukraine has to do with Russia's unfortunate involvement there. That said, I did want to mention an article that came out in the Washington Post in the last week. It's about Ukraine, and so obviously I'm not a Ukraine expert, but I'm still recommending this article. The title is "Slow Counteroffensive Darkens Mood in Ukraine," and it has three authors. Oh boy, I'm worried about mispronouncing this. Siobhan, that doesn't sound right. Siobhan O'Grady. I don't know if I'm probably not saying that right. And then there's Konstantin Hudov and Heidi Levine. I'm pretty confident in the pronunciation of that last one. But those are the three authors, and it is a very, very grim read. There's one line that stood out to me, and it is, "Ukrainians, much in need of good news, are simply not getting any." So that's like a sample of like the vibe here. And the article itself is not you know, one of these articles with all the lines and arrows pointing up, you know, where the counteroffensive isn't making progress or where it's not making enough progress. It's interviews with people on the ground, and just kind of, it's just human interest stuff. It's just people dealing with the struggles and tragedies of this war, you know, Ukrainians. And it's a real tough read. And I recommend it just because, not because this is the true face of the war. I mean, it is that, it's certainly that, but you know, there's more to it, obviously. But what I took away from it is just that this is not an experience that I will ever be able to understand, at least not unless something as horrible happens to the, you know, the United States or something, because what they're going through in Ukraine is so far removed from anything I've lived that I you read an article like this, and I saw some of the reactions were, I mean, this happens whenever you share an article from a major news outlet, but some people were like, oh, you know, it's so down on the Ukrainian mood because the Washington Post is bullshit. Like, don't read the Washington Post. And you can have issues with any media outlet. Go ahead. But this, you know, these are interviews with individuals, and it's really insulting, I think, to the people that are interviewed for these stories. And I'm sure that most of them don't, you know, that maybe they don't even speak English. So it's not as though they're going to be, you know, searching social media for the reactions of random people to quotes in an article that appeared in the Washington Post. But spare a thought, I guess, for what that experience might be like, to sort of pour your heart out to a reporter about a tragedy that you're experiencing personally, and for someone to kind of respond with the sort of what I assume are the partisan politics of domestic American politics, or maybe you don't like that some of these people, the critics of this article maybe just thought that it's too you know, depressing, too down, and maybe therefore somehow undermining of either the Ukrainian war effort or support for Ukraine, and so important to just push back against it and criticize the concept of the article. I don't think that's a good approach. I understand the politics of that. I understand that if someone says something that is unflattering or depressing or pessimistic about Ukraine's war effort or experiences or you know, future in this war, that if your goal is essentially in anything you say publicly to further the chances of Ukraine winning, you might say, okay, well, that's not helping, therefore it's part of the problem, I'm going to oppose it or whatever. But from my perspective, just as somebody observing this space, this area where people live, and trying to take in as much kind of information and as many perspectives and experiences as I can, I'm really grateful for a story like this, and I do hope more people read it. Another text, or this, in this case, an essay related to Ukraine again, that appeared in Carnegie. I always want to say Carnegie because, you know, the joke about Carnegie Hall, but I'm pretty sure you say Carnegie. Anyway, you know what I'm talking about. An essay by an economist, an oil and gas expert, Sergei Valyutkinka. Vakulenka. Sergei Vakulenka. He has an essay all about how the war in the Black Sea, which is really generating a lot of headlines in the last few weeks, he says it might soon come to resemble the Persian Gulf during the Iran-Iraq war in the 1980s. And so he's arguing that basically the oil trade is so lucrative that even if they start shooting at ships that are crossing through the waters, that people will still do it, even if the insurance rates go sky high, that there's basically, it's just, there's too much money involved that the trade will continue. And he also argues that from the Moscow side, Moscow might start escalating by targeting Ukraine's Danube, I think that's how you say it, Danube is the E silent, the Danube Delta ports. This is like the ports that Ukraine has that are very close to Romania. And Vakulenka argues that this is easier to do than trying to stop every ship that's crossing through the Black Sea and trying to decide, okay, what flag are they flying? That one gets a pass. Well, that one doesn't, and so on and so forth. Just blow up the ports, and then they don't have anywhere to go. Vakulenka argues that that's going to be Russia's next strategy, maybe. Ukraine, on the other hand, they might start targeting the oil terminals in Novorossiysk, and this would force Russia essentially to start moving a lot of its, where they send the oil and gas through pipelines all the way up to the Baltic Sea. That would raise costs a lot, et cetera, et cetera. One of great, cool stuff. But one of the interesting things I thought that I read in this article was that he argues that Ukraine is unlikely to attack oil tankers for fear of causing an ecological disaster in the Black Sea. And there was actually, the previous week, there was an attack by a naval drone against a Russian oil tanker, but the oil tanker was empty. And so I guess we can expect, and we have seen, Ukrainian attacks against Russian oil tankers, but I guess they know, I don't know, through fancy intelligence, or they can just look and see if the boat is, like, you know, sunken low into the water, which means it's full of oil or not. I don't know how they tell this, but it seems like we're going to see attacks on oil tankers, but maybe just empty ones. I guess that's what we've seen so far. But the concept of a potential ecological disaster in the Black Sea is very interesting. And I do wonder what would happen if a Russian oil tanker is hit and actually leaks a bunch of oil into the Black Sea and it splashes up against all the, you know, countries that have shores there. And if Ukraine's responsible for that attack, you know, how would that play out? I'm sure that would work out well for Russia, except for all the oil that would wash under their shores too. But in terms of, like, you know, publicity and PR or whatever, that would be a real interesting development in the war. And I'm sure this is one of the reasons that Vakulenka argues that Ukraine won't do that because they don't want to deal with that. Another interesting story over the last week, VPNs and Google services in Russia. Roskomnadzor, Russia's federal censor, is now apparently gunning for VPN protocols, which is a sort of different internet censorship that we've seen before. And the main takeaway my main takeaway from reading stories about this in the last week is that they're targeting VPNs, which, if you're not sure what those are, people use those to circumvent, you know, internet censorship. Like if your internet service provider is blocking a particular website or web domain or whatever, you log into a VPN, and then you can visit those sites. And Roskomnadzor is apparently targeting VPN protocols in such a way that they're now blocking access for individuals, but they're somehow able to do it in a way that it doesn't disrupt major businesses. Because this was a concern in the past, is that when they would do these blanket bans that were kind of primitive compared to what they're doing now, it would actually disrupt, you know, major corporate actions, I guess, because corporations rely on access to things that are banned in Russia. And so it was basically a big obstacle to Russia's internet censorship that they had to worry about that. And now apparently they're using technology that allows them to stop individuals from accessing things, but they can, you know, they can spare the the major businesses. And so that's obviously that would allow greater internet censorship than we've seen. Just a few hours ago, there were headlines that Google, I think the website Google or maybe all Google services were suddenly unavailable to a lot of internet users, a lot of mobile internet users across Russia. Roskomnadzor put out a statement saying that they were not blocking Google services, but they took that chance to also mention that people should be using domestic things. I assume they mean like Yandex and other things like that. But just a few days before that, we did see reports that Google was starting to block access to its workspaces, like Google Docs, Google Sheets, all that kind of stuff, for some Russian companies that have been sanctioned in the West. And this, one of the companies that was named in these reports was the facial recognition developer Entech Lab. And you may have heard of that company before, because in the last few years, it's been a few years now, I guess, because this is back when Russia still had protests to speak of, political protests. But they developed software that allowed facial recognition to basically find people and then link them to their social media accounts so that they could be identified, and then it was easier to, you could find someone at a protest and find their anti-government posts, and it would be a lot easier to prosecute them for various political crimes and so on. So Entech Lab is apparently losing its Google Workspace access. Very sad. Near the end of this week, Alexei Navalny released an essay from prison where he talked at length about the 1990s, and he has some really powerful statements, I guess we could call them. He says things like, "I hate the independent media and the democratic society that provided full support for one of the most dramatic turning points in our new history, the fraudulent presidential election of 1996. He says that he's very afraid that the battle for principles may be lost again under the slogans of realpolitik. And he says that, compromise, political compromise is necessary, but he also says that a good future for Russia relies on a Russian opposition that under no circumstances will accept fake elections, improper judicial proceedings, and corruption, that sort of thing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. He names Venediktov and Maxim Katz and, several of his rivals from over the years within the opposition, whom he's always argued that, they don't deserve opposition credit in the first place. And so, a big shot across the bow, I suppose, although it's not the first of its kind, but really pretty powerful language. And he's clearly, I'm doing a bit of remote mind reading or psychology here, but it seems to me that he's really settling into what he hopes will be a Mandela role for the future. Interesting, certainly interesting. I've always been fascinated by maybe it's not fair to call it infighting, because Navalny certainly doesn't consider Venediktov and people like him to be his colleagues or anything. But let's just say the rivalry between people like Venediktov and Navalny, people like Maxim Katz and Navalny, has a lot to do with what kind of compromise they consider to be acceptable. And Navalny at this point now, he can basically lay claim to, he is the most uncompromising, right? Because he's essentially surrendered his life to Russia's political, prisons. And so he's now, the Putin regime remains in place for the next 50 years, Navalny will likely die in jail. Maybe it won't take that long either, because it seems like they're mistreating him quite badly behind bars now. So that's not to say that it's easy for him to suggest that, the kinds of compromises people are making now are unacceptable. Certainly not easy, since he's essentially being tortured in prison. But at the same time, it's natural for him to, I guess, stake that claim on a kind of uncompromising, or at least a far less compromising approach to politics and so on. I would note that, he has participated in elections before, and in the Putin era, when they were hardly free and fair. And so it seems like he's now kind of changed his thinking. And the essay that he published is about the 1990s and about kind of the beginnings of the modern, super presidency in Russia. But, Navalny was willing to work within the system a little bit more before than apparently he is now. But still, very interesting essay. Navalny is obviously a very inspiring political figure. And, who am I to judge this man? One of the things I've been trying to do on social media in the last few months, I've been watching with great envy as people like Francis Scar, and the war translated guy on Twitter, who has just like a bajillion followers, and every video he publishes has like 90 billion likes and views and all this. I watch these guys. They publish these videos that essentially are I mean, they do a lot of work. I'm not putting them down. But what I notice from kind of a technical standpoint is that they find videos on social media, and then they subtitle them and they release them. And then everyone views them because now they're accessible in English. And so I've been trying to do a little bit of this myself. And essentially, if you load the Telegram app in the web browser, you can do this on the mobile app too. But for whatever reason, it doesn't seem possible on the desktop version, like the official desktop app on a Mac. Doesn't seem possible. But anyway, you search and you can search by media, and then it basically gives you all the videos in chronological order from all your channels. Pretty neat, because there's no way to view the posts like that. But you view the videos and you find some interesting videos. And so I've been trying to do this subtitle. I'm trying to subtitle various interesting videos in English. And two of the videos that I caught in the last week that I thought were pretty interesting, and as I talk about them, I'm hoping there'll be something in common that makes a comparison worthwhile. But the videos I'm thinking of, one is by Alexander Dudka, the collaborationist mayor of a town in the occupied Kherson region. And then there's another one where it shows these women arguing at a playground somewhere in Krasnodar, where an argument breaks out after one mother apparently criticizes this group of other women who had assembled, you know, I guess near this public park, right outside of it, right next to it, to weave camouflage nets for their sons and husbands at the front. And I guess this woman came over and said, like, you know, I don't want this military stuff next to the playground. And then a big fight broke out, verbal fight. But let's get to the Dudka video first. So this mayor guy, collaborationist mayor, Russia-appointed mayor, released this video where he's sitting at his desk and he has like some papers in front of him. I don't think he's reading from the papers, but so I guess he's speaking from the heart, or he's memorized it. But he refers to the papers at various points. And quite a few threats, actually, to his constituents, I suppose, where he's really arguing that parents and locals need to adopt Russian citizenship, they need to get their Russian passport, and they need to send their children to the new Russian-controlled schools. And he says that he has a list of all children who have been truant, who haven't attended these new Russian-controlled schools, and he says, I'm going to send you to the border, and then you'll go learn your native language, meaning Ukrainian. And what wasn't clear to me in the video that I watched is if he's saying he'll send just the parents and keep the children, or if he'll send the whole family, I suppose whichever one's scarier is the one he'd like you to believe or like them to believe. And he refers to people as Zdunov, I think, which is like people like waiting for the Ukrainians to return. But it's sort of sounds like a insult against mentally retarded people, I suppose. And so that's the idea behind that word. He uses it quite a bit. And then he also says that he's going to refuse insulin and other medicines to people who haven't gotten their Russian citizenship, and refuse just sort of government social spending in general to anybody. So, you know, he's going to make homeless. If he's going to make them homeless, then he's going to prosecute the parents, and then he's going to deport the parents, I guess. And he finishes with just sort of some rather vague threats of just sort of the one. He says, like, the police are on my side, or I'm sure the police are on my side. So just kind of the threats kind of escalate and then become vague. And it sounds like he's just going to start, you know, rounding people up. Pretty insane. The guy sounds insane. And so I just, again, as I mentioned earlier when I was talking about the article about from the Washington Post about the mood in Ukraine, is that I can't honestly fathom. I mean, I can watch this video. I can write the English language subtitles for it. I can, you know, I can search for little sayings and try to understand like some of the jargon he's using and feel like for a moment at least like, oh, okay, I'm kind of in this guy's head. But when I look back and listen to the whole thing, I can't actually imagine living in that situation. Like I try to think of like the mayor of New Haven. You know, he's quite active on Twitter. If he releases this video on Twitter and he says something like, if you're not sending your children to this or that school, then I'm going to, you know, deport you. I mean, honestly, I'm not a big fan of Connecticut. So depending on where I was deported, it doesn't sound all that bad. But you see, I'm making jokes. And obviously, the situation is not very funny in Ukraine there. So yeah, just another, I don't know, horrifying episode out of occupied Ukraine. And if you haven't watched the video, consider watching it just because it is so kind of unreal, unbelievable, and you kind of need to see it with your own eyes. This other video that I mentioned, this clash of mothers in Krasnodar, another kind of telling, I think, I think it's telling. I read quite a bit into this exchange, actually, because on one hand, there's a woman and her kind of adult daughter, at least that's how it's been described in the media, and they're standing in the playground. Maybe the younger daughter has an even younger daughter. I don't know why they were in the playground. But on one hand, it's, you know, surprising that someone would actually confront a bunch of women doing some kind of war-related public action and tell them essentially to buzz off, that, you know, like, this is not appropriate for an area where children gather. So that right away I thought was interesting that someone would say that, because you get the impression that it's so that there's been so many controls placed on political speech that someone would just be afraid to say anything that is remotely critical of the war or anybody who's expressing support for it. And yet, you know, this woman came up and I guess said, like, you know, please get out of here. It's not clear what she did say to begin with, because the video begins with the argument already underway. But then when this group of women who are sewing or weaving these camouflage nets, you know, they push back, and the woman on camera, the one who, I guess, criticized them, she says things like, you know, I didn't sell my husband and children off to the war. And so there's like a clear class element here, right? That, like, oh, you know, you're poor, you took the money and you exchanged your loved ones for some cash, you know, for their pay or for their the awards you get if you die, the awards that go to your family and so on. So some real class clashes here. That's obviously interesting for a Russia watcher. And then the group of women, they tell her that they're going to report her, you know. And again, at this point, she hasn't done anything that is commonly illegal, although I guess under the kind of militarized speech laws that Russia has passed, I'm sure it would not be difficult to argue that she committed a crime by saying you sold your husbands and children off or whatever, because that sounds like, I'm sure you could easily say that is, you know, discrediting the armed forces or something like that, which is a crime in Russia now, or it's illegal at least. I can't remember if discrediting first time is a misdemeanor, repeat can become a felony, and then disinformation, which again, all this stuff in court can be defined so loosely, maybe you could say that's disinformation because they weren't sold off or something, and then that's an instant felony. So she's certainly flirting with criminal activity here. In the heat of the moment, she still went for it. And in the aftermath, one of these Z bloggers identified her, doxed her, and then there was an online campaign to get her fired and get the police involved. All the stuff you'd expect in this day and age in Russia. But yeah, that was an interesting video that circulated. Anyway, those are the show notes I put together. I don't know if this was interesting for anybody. I think I enjoyed it. I'll have to reflect on the experience in the morning. But like I said, I just am kind of, I wanted to get back in front of a mic and just sort of run my mouth again, because I feel like I've lost that by just doing interview format podcasts. So very self-indulgent. I apologize to those of you that sat through the whole thing and at the end decided that it was no good. Whether anybody listens to this or not, I had a good time. I think, like I said, I'm going to revisit that. But thanks again, and thanks for listening to The Russia Guy. Говорят мы бяки-буки, как выносит нас земля. Дайте, что ли, карты в руки, погадать на короля. Ой-ля-ля, ой-ля-ля.